Hello, everybody. Very nice to be here tonight. Very nice for me to hear so many people and get up and read poems that they wrote very quickly in response to that challenge in the first half. I was very impressed. I'll be reading mostly tonight from this collection, The Spanish Italians Order. But I'm going to start with one poem that's not in the book, in honour of a friend that's here tonight. Many years ago, I lived in a squat in Camden Town, and it was a very happy experience. It was quite an interesting household, and I think it was very good for us all. We were all very young, we were all a bit mad, but it was partly what sorted us out, I think. So this poem is called The Squat. It comes back to me now, out of the rain, the seasons having fled so quickly. We are all either gone to the four corners or lie quietly dead among our own. The house that needed its door prized off with a crowbar, the crust chipped from the base of the loo with a knife, the garden emptied of crud, dead fridges, such like, before we could live in it with our various accents, our scatter of languages, our different takes on life, French, Catalan, Spanish, Dublin, Scouse, even one Americano. The house took us all, though a boy from somewhere up north stepped outside in his car. I wouldn't say it was too far a stretch of the imagination to say we were an education for each other. We cooked vegetarian, were cool and communal, read Down and Out in Paris and London. Our bath gave no hot water, so that in winter there were times, obviously there was no central heating either, when, in spite of all our running around with steaming pans, by the time one's arse sank into the chilly water, you had generally forgotten what it was you were after. We each had many an icy eureka moment. Some mornings we all rose together as if bidden, and dozy with sleep made our way to the sitting room table. We'd have thrown back the curtains if we had had them, and Bob dropped the stylus and made us all coffee. And we breakfasted there with the sun streaming in to Morrissey, the violent fans, the undertone, the Vivaldi. So because this is a first collection, it's fairly wide ranging. It's not just all of one theme, so I'll be hopping around a bit as I read. I'll start with a little poem. You know, when you're a kid and you're learning everything, and perhaps in this country, certainly, you know, where I grew up, you know, you're learning religion as well. But because you're a kid, it's like a story, isn't it? And it seeps into everything else. Because children have such amazing minds, don't they? They don't really compartmentalize the world the way we do later. The sacred and the profane. Lie down and give them a suck, the old man said, pointing at the puppies ringed round the bitch, who reclined on her side in the straw. You give them a suck, you old bastard, shouted the 8-year-old girl, and they both burst out laughing. While the bitch, with her silver coat and her glimmering eyes, clattered her tail in the golden straw and smiled like a dolphin. And the puppies swam at her breast in a cradle of straw, and the red heat lamp overhead gave everything a sort of holy glow. I'm going to read a sort of list poem now. Well, it is a list poem. It's about the colour yellow. And if I read in England, I always have to say there's one word in it in Irish, bwí, which means
yellow.
Thank you. The only hue. Yellow the bitch with morning sickness, yellow the queasy tint of dawn, yellow the book and yellow the sun, yellow the chair I'm sitting on, yellow the sunflower, here our soul, yellow the field of rape, a full-on retina-punching whack of yellow, and a softer yellow the corn. All the painterly names for yellow line up, jostle, elbow each other. Ochre, Tuscan, cadmium, chrome, lemon, Flanders, Sahara, bwí. Old Yeller was yellow before he died, and yellow's the rose of Banksia. one of our bantams turned yellow for love. Yellow is the fox that dreams thereof. Yellow are the eyes of the turtle dove that puffs its breast and croons and trills. Gauguin loved yellow, his favourite colour. His Christ is yellow with new tristesse. His Breton women wear green gold hay against a yellow Breton sea. And many a token of love is yellow, a yellow ribbon, an amber ring, a bowl of lemony apricots, a yellow apple, perhaps one bite taken from its perfect curve, a straw-coloured trickle on a loved one's chin. So, when we set down this quince, which seems to emit a halo of yellow as its fecund scent pervades the room, know this: the apple of love takes many forms. Its palm can thicken and must wherever, regardless of when or who or why, but always has this colour, golden, yellow, bright, abstruse, a light shower shaken, perhaps from the sun or the yellow moon above. Whatever, rest in its honey glow a while, its trust, its thrust, its acid yellow probe. I'm going to read a slightly darker set of poems now, just for a bit. I'll read a poem. The first poem is called Stink. And the first of this little set is called Stink. It's set on... It's partly about where we draw the line. It's touching on the subject of incest. It's set on Inishmore, off County Clare, off the coast of County Clare. But that's by the by, and I think there are some foreign language students being bowled over in a boat and sitting on the island, exploring the islands. Bridget appears in the poem. Of course, she is Saint Bridget, but in her older existence, she was a goddess. And in England, I always have to say, there's two Irish words in this poem, mítreachtaíoch, pitiless, and cruálach, cruel. Excuse my bad accent. Stink. Clare is just a green line on the mainland. Dún Aengusa in August, and the breeze coming off the sea eats her words. The smell of salt, fish, a whiff of incest. We cannot hear ourselves, our dialects mingle. The fortress faces out toward the west. The sea hums in toward it, yellow, grey. We speak, but the wind takes our voices. Our picnic lies in disarray around us, and Clare is just a green line on the mainland. There is a line that should never be crossed. Que vista, que isolamento, le irlandesi? Some blame religion, monogamy, evolution. But here walks Bridget, out from a rock, a sod of magic butter in her hand, followed by a line of feral cows. Her lips are moving. Deep cattle groans drown her out. We barely catch her growl. Mítreachtaíoch, cruálach, selfish. She spits, draws a line across the turf. This next poem I'm going to read is set in London. And it's about a murder case where it's true, where you know, a few years ago, two young-ish women living right on the edges of society, you know, involved in drugs and petty prostitution, were murdered. And the murder came to light when a tramp found their body parts in a bin. Anyway, it's obviously a very sad story, but what interested me was the tramp's reaction, what he did when he found these body parts, because he didn't call the police, he probably didn't trust the police. He took them to a hospital. London Hospital for Tropical Diseases, 2003. Detectives made the discovery after a tramp found the remains of two women, Sky News. Behold, this gentleman of the street passed by, his ragged coat, tramp stink, blue watery eyes, his bulbous nose, a full exotic blue, a face so marked and battered he could be Lear, after he's come to know himself most truly. Behold his enormous hands, how they are full weighted. Two bin bags, the plastic shining darkly in the winter sun. How he shuffles along, carefully holding his burden. Not a man afraid of touching dirt or rummaging through it. He seems intent. It's possible he is praying, or singing even. It might be fal de la, as he leans to hand them over at reception. Those body parts, those girls, to this place of healing. The next poem came about because of a person working in the hospital, Mental Health Foundation Trust, who had to compile notes for a suicide audit. That means an audit was of people who had killed themselves while under the care of the Mental Health Foundation Trust. Not necessarily inmates, but people under the care of. The suicides. Softly, they settle around me now. Gentle birds come home to roost, dropping and shuffling one by one onto the desk, open drawers, heap directories, nursing tracts. They do not breathe, but we might be swapping breath, in for out, so close they are, so present. They are weightless, obviously, and yet so great their need or mine. We press forehead to forehead, one by one, each for a second only, until we have all touched. The hospital, Victorian and beautiful, is still. My list is cruel. Their various ends, hanged, fell from height, overdose, etc., make for hard reading. Some were very young. Many received the best of care. I sigh. We, the suicides and I, put down our books, pens, burdens, leave the building. Excuse me, sucking so much in between my poems, but I get a dry mouth. I'll read two poems now about two people, two older people with two different types of dementia. The first one is about an older man who has what's called Diogenes syndrome. And it's so called because with that type of dementia, a person slips into living in their own filth, literally in their own filth, but completely unaware of it. So that is the sign of Diogenes syndrome. Obviously it's called after the Greek philosopher. Diogenes syndrome. Old man, we can barely enter for the stench, the ever-ripening fetor that swarms your flat, that creeps beneath your door, your carpet dappled with piles of your own manure, your bath piled high with stuff, the toilet blocked with floating Vesuvius at its brim. It's been some time we interview you elsewhere. The doctor notes your gentleness and filth, your gummy smile, lank hair, and jovial good humour. You swear you eat, mention cans of beer. You even lie and say you exercise, which makes us laugh, or how we laugh at that. You only cry once when you mention rent. You fear perhaps the landlord wants you out. You don't know why. My dear, it's not too late. We'll scrub you up, allocate you your own social worker. It'll not happen again, not to you, and we're sorry that it even happened once. Not that you even know what we're on about. Nor are we enough to force aside that thing, that whatever it is, that blocks your light. In the second poem of an older person, it's an older lady who has Alzheimer's. She's in her 80s, so she's old enough to remember the Second World War. But she's coping quite well. Vera. Vera, 80-something, sprightly yet, lives with her daughter in her council flat. She keeps it spick and span, immaculate. Her short-term memory's gone, or going fast, her grandchildren a blur. She loves them all, but cannot place a face. Her eyes are not where she last laid them. The front door flies open in the middle of the night. She knows her husband's dead these 20 years, but they were happy and can't say what he did. Still manages to shop and use the stairs, takes all her meds and likes to watch TV. Has only one perceptual delusion. Each night she sees a soldier in her room, standing in the corner, leaning on his rifle, looking toward her. She thinks he's real. This does not disturb her. So, I'm going to read some Spanish-themed poems now. This poem is called The Spanish-Italian Border. I'm just trying my page. Spanish-Italian border. This poem came about because I have a friend, another writer, Sam Barraclough, in London, and he says to me one night when we were in our cups, why don't we get a house together, you know, in a cottage somewhere, and that way we can each kind of earn our living but support each other in our writing or whatever. But he wanted to run off and live in Italy, and I wanted to run off and live in Spain, so I says, equally in my cups, how can we live together when you want to live in Italy and I want to live in Spain? He says, ah, we'll get a house in the Spanish-Italian border. So it made me laugh, the idea of going to live in a non-existent place. It also made me think about what it would be like perhaps having to learn a non-existent language. So, the Spanish-Italian border. When you first mentioned the villa on the Spanish-Italian border to which we might abscond and there live out our lives, in a utopian idyll of sun and passata, I instantly saw in the far, far distance, among sheep festooned with golden bells, a whitewashed house, a vine-covered trellis, a sun-dappled patio, a lemon tree grove. Whispering natives with a strange patois, their kindly gifts of dried goat, wine, and us conversing over their heads, me in Spanish, you in Italian, with many accompanying gesticulations. And somebody knitting, perhaps, in a corner, the bony needles clacking and clicking, as you spit on the floor and I pound the table, and one of us smashes a glass to the wall. Friend, we are both in the heat of our lives. Let us kiss, then turn ourselves back to back. I'll face the Atlantic, you the Adriatic. Let us each stride out for our separate countries. Yet know that our hearts are sunk in wool, bound by a skein that will never unwind, to be always connected through our mutual love of a fairly exclusive, unheard-of language, that we always meet up in far-flung places, as yet unmapped, as yet unfound. All of my poems are in English, obviously, but the Spanish-themed ones often have a Spanish title. The next poem is called Mariposa de Noche, which just means butterfly of the night, and is the expression some Spanish people use for moth, butterfly of the night. Mariposa de Noche. In a glass on the bedside table, a moth is floating on water, wings spread out like a biplane. This is Granada, Spain. The shutters are fastened against the morning sun. The room is dusky. She is barely able to see the glass, let alone the flutter at its rim. One sip, she is also muddled by sleep. Some poems have happy ending, some things transmute. The worm becometh a phoenix, verily. Night floater, your death wish belies itself. Her gulp belies what she loves. All the circlings of night, the purr of insect life against a wall, everything that's solitary, strange. The draw toward a flame, the need to burn, or touch the moon, drown in its embrace, poet-like. Here I refer to Lee Bai, who reached for a reflection on the water and reaching drowned. A window opens, a glass upturns, mottled wings shiver in the sun. Night glider, she hums, as if her throat were crammed with crawling moths, as if their throng might force her mouth, let fly, marbled white, death's head, Luna, Queen of Spain, underwing, gypsy. The next Spanish-themed poem doesn't actually have does have a Spanish title. It's called La Vida Gitana, which means this gypsy life, which in Spanish, as I think it would mean in English, means a wandering life also. The guy on the front cover of the book is Choro Humo. He's a 19th century gypsy from Granada. He was known as the Prince of the Gypsies. I think we'd say the King of the Gypsies, but the Prince of the Gypsies. And he became famous. There's now a statue of him in Granada because in the 19th century, wealthy people, when they were doing their tour of Europe, they'd end up in Granada outside the Alhambra and they'd enjoy it and they'd go on their way. Choro Humo was the first person to work out how to make money from tourists in Granada. And he did it by dressing up as a bandolero, a bandit, a bandito, and telling his completely fictitious life story to these tourists for money. And he became very famous and he was photographed, therefore we have this photograph. Anyway, I like his story, and it made me think about the fictions we use, and also the gypsies of Granada. I mean, they have a patron saint who is fictitious, but doesn't exist, etc. So it's partly about that, and perhaps my wandering life. La vida gitana. So, here I am, thinking about the cave I might have bought at the time being right, or the papers existed. Its cool, dark chambers of clear blue vistas straight across to the Alhambra. Choro Humo, you dressed up as a bandolero, sold your story to the tourist throng, the first of an intricate series of cons. I wish I had half your authenticity. Gypsy Prince, your eyes are milky, your cataracts caught in the camera's flash. Sepia King, be easy on me. I live in a time when fiction is easy. And your sacred mountain, your broken alley, your holy book written lead, your ancient scripts of fictive saints, were all invented, a giant hoax, about as true as, say, this telling of my fortune by the cathedral, lucky in love, she pounds my euros. The wind is up, there's rent to pay, and money owed, and furniture to be moved again across the sea. Sunstruck and dry, I sip my mosto. I'll read two more poems. The next two are sort of Irish themes. Based in Ireland. First is a short one. It's called a Swanky, and I don't know how many of you are old enough to. I remember a time when many of my older relations, perhaps more in the country, when they smiled, gave you a great gummy smile. And then I remember, I can't remember exactly when it changed, but I remember a time when that changed. I don't know if it was a government initiative or not. Swanky, by the way. And nothing could beat my surprise, age 10, when I walked into the yard and saw them again after the better part of a year. My two great uncles, Mick and John, standing up straight with their Wellingtons on, I think they were seeing to a poorly heifer, and smiling their welcomes. Their toothless grins, pink, gummy, and always complicit in whatever japes we were up to, were gone, replaced by the best teeth that could be got this side of the horse and jockey. They looked so good that I truly can't say I've ever seen men more handsome. With their new American film star smiles and their white hair beautifully grill creamed, three strands smoothed down over each bald pate, they were Spencer Tracy, Cary Grant. my readers call the blush. Again, it's kind of an Irish poem, but it looks, I spend a lot of my time on the formative prayer, even though it's all I'm from Dublin. You know what a bender is, if people live by the side of the road? If you're a traveller, a bender is a kind of temporary dwelling made by putting a top on over bendy willow sticks. It's not the other kind of thing. Let me think about this. There's an expression in this poem in Spanish, olor gitano. It means gypsy smell, or gypsy smell, and in Spanish it's slightly derogatory. But what it actually is the smell of smoke that you get if you've ever lived out around a campfire. Any time I've done that, I can't wash my clothes afterwards, I like the smell so much. Olor gitano. What else? You probably didn't swear very much when you were children, but we did. Plus, I'm sure you know how many teats a nanny goat has. Okay. The blush. Oh, and that word tinker, we can't use it really anymore, it's not correct, and I understand why, but it is a beautiful word. It's a pity it became derogatory. The blush. He lived down the Littleton Road in his bender, a homemade number, just a piece of green tarp pulled over bent willow. There he tended his she-goat and minded the fire with bits odds of turf, old pieces of timber. A gentle old man, he came up to our farm only for water. It fell into the pail from the tap in the yard. As shy as a wild hare, he'd nod his head, he'd nod back at him, and then he would smile. When the bucket was brimful, it was back to the bender, to the shaggy white she-goat with vertical pupils and dun-yellow eyes. Well-mannered tinker, when once I swore, out of plain wonder, with that flowery vocab country children acquired, one hot afternoon, as I passed by his site, with its smoky smell, its olor gitano. Lord Jesus Almighty, she's only two tits. For all other beasts in the known world had 4 or 8 or sometimes 12, except for us, to my girlish knowledge. He coloured and flushed, and a ruddy tinge seeped up from his neck and rattled his face, and further rose this fiery blush to his freckled ears, their hot, translucent tips. Mm.